Shimon Wedowinski, a professor at Florida International University's Institute of Environment, said an analysis of a space-based radar data revealed signs of such subsidence at the site of the tower disaster in 1990s. We reported about 2 millimeters per year over a period of 6 years, so that comes to about 12 millimeters, about half an inch, or about the width of your finger, Wedowinski told the Weather Channel, adding, so small things and slow processes can accumulate if you give them enough time. Separately, Wedowinski said that when we measure subsidence or when we see movement of the buildings, it's worth checking why it happens. We cannot say that what is the reason for that from the satellite images, but we can say there was movement here, he added. Like many cities around the world, Miami is taking steps in an effort to mitigate the effects of rising sea levels and sinking land. According to Miami's Storm Water Master Plan, installing a system of pumps, drainage, and sea walls would cost approximately $4 billion and still leave some areas without adequate protection. However, experts warn that only urgent transformational action can avert worst-case climate scenarios, and that attempting to merely treat the symptoms of the climate emergency with measures like sea walls will ultimately fail. In a 2019 Popular article, essayist Sarah Miller wrote that since Miami is built on limestone, which soaks up water like a sponge, walls are not very useful. In Miami, seawater will just go under a wall like a salty ghost. It will come up through the pipes and seep up around the manholes. It will soak into the sand and find its way into caves and get under the water table and push the groundwater up. So while walls might keep the clogs of Holland dry, they cannot offer similar protection to the stilettos of Miami Beach, she said. Harold Wanless, a geologist and sea level rise expert at the University of Miami, told The Guardian that every sandy barrier island, every low-lying coast from Miami to Mumbai will become inundated and it will be difficult to maintain functional infrastructure. Wanless said you can't put valves in sewers and put it sea levels, but the problem is the water will keep coming up through the limestone. You're not going to stop this.
Around the World with Reporters.
Yemen's Ministry of Electricity held a sit-in protest in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to call on the international community to step in and to pressure Saudi Arabia to stop detaining Yemeni oil vessels. The ministry said it is unable to generate power anymore due to the lack of fuel.
Electricity is an essential service and has nothing to do with any political conflicts. The power sector in Yemen has been heavily affected since the first moment of the war. The Saudi-led coalition has directly targeted all electric power plants, and this is a great tragedy for us. The UN has not done anything to end the suffering of Yemenis. We demand the lifting of the siege and releasing the oil ships so we can generate electricity again.
At the same place, Yemeni children organized a gallery for the drawings. The gallery was named The U.S. Kills Our Childhood and exhibited children's drawings that show the suffering of Yemeni children due to the ongoing conflict.
We participated in this protest to tell the United Nations, which classified Ansarullah in its blacklist of groups violating children's rights, We Yemenis demand our rights like any other people, on top of which is the lifting of the siege imposed on us by Saudi Arabia.
How many fathers and mothers have lost their children? This is a massive crime. This is tyranny. We are little children. We have no fault.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on the impoverished country in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and imposing an all-out blockade. Yemenis have held hundreds of protests here in front of the United Nations office, but the international body has not yet taken any strict measures to end the suffering of the millions of Yemenis. That is why the UN describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana.
The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, is standing trial for allegations of culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other charges which the Islamic cleric has denied. Rounding up his address to the court, the leader of the defense team explained that the prosecution has not established any case against Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki. He said none of the people accused of the crimes attributed it to his client, and the court has released many of them.
If we feel that no prima facie case has been established against your client, you make a no-case submission, and that is what has happened in this case. So we are waiting for the ruling of the court.
The prosecution has presented a total of 15 witnesses, including Nigerian military officers. But Zazaki's defense team said all the witnesses that were brought before the court confirmed that they did not see Sheikh Zazaki during the attack by the army.
The prosecution called 15 witnesses. We felt that no case has been made to warrant our clients being asked to give evidence. In other words, we address the court to defend that there is nothing to defend on the part of our client.
The trial judge adjourned the case to July 28, when he is expected to deliver his ruling on the no-case submission by Zazaki's defense team. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention since December 2015 after soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have continued with their protests, demanding the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat. They have always insisted that the Islamic cleric is an innocent man who has suffered persecution by the Nigerian government. Anjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Bashir Ahmed Baba is a free man now. 12 years back, he was detained at the Gujarat state of India for a crime he was unaware of.
I used to work for a German-based NGO. I and my colleague, who was non-Kashmiri, had gone to attend a training workshop on children with disabilities. It was a two-week-long program, but I was detained on the sixth day while my colleague was set free.
Baba was detained under a controversial Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, or UAPA, and was accused of making bombs in soft drink cans.
I was unaware of what I was being questioned about. I even couldn't read the charge sheet because it was in the local language. But one thing I was sure about is that one day I would walk free because I knew I was innocent. But I never knew it would take 12 years to prove it.
Unlawful activity is defined vaguely in the law as any action, whether by an individual or an association, which disclaims, questions, disrupts, or is intended to disrupt the sovereignty and territorial integrity of India, or causes or is intended to cause disaffection against India. According to the National Crime Records Bureau data, there's a rising graph of UAPA cases in Jammu and Kashmir. The UAPA law has come under stern criticism after several activists and journalists in India were booked under it by the Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party. Scores of Kashmiris are languishing in the jails across India. Providing legal aid and frequent meeting with the prisoners has become a challenge for their families.
In these 12 years, I have seen him once, that only after I sold my gold earring. We were drained financially after his father died of cancer, so going to him was out of our bounds.
Analysts say unlawful detention is a violation of human rights, and the covenants of civil and political rights say such people need to be compensated for unlawful detention, and for those who have falsely implicated them also need to be tried in the name of malicious prosecution.
In India, in case of Muslims in general and Kashmiris in particular, the law enforcing authorities have been given a license to harass, implicate and detain without any cause. That is why we find Muslim population in India is just 15%, whereas 35% prisoners of India are Muslims, and most of them are falsely implicated.
Sheikh added, Kashmir is an exceptional case where New Delhi has placed laws that allow authorities to detain people without any reason. Baba is happy to be back and is rejoicing the reunion with his family members. However, is in a constant dilemma where and how to start fresh. Shahana Bhatt, Internet Minister at Kashmir.
For the first time in decades, Canada Day celebrations have been mostly muted as the country sees old wounds reopened. Various cities scrapped the celebrations following a series of horrific discoveries of unmarked graves around former Catholic schools for Indigenous children. Calls to scale back or cancel celebrations snowballed in May and June when almost 1,000 unmarked graves were found. Another discovery this week, comprising 182 graves of children aged 7 to 15, made matters even worse. The new findings have fueled outrage in the country over a lack of information and accountability regarding violations of Indigenous people's rights. The graves remind people of the horrors experienced by thousands of kids that were supposed to be assimilated into the white society in church-run boarding schools. Rallies have been held to honor over 4,000 victims of Canada's infamous residential schools, while Indigenous leaders have been calling for a thorough investigation. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the discoveries as a shameful reminder of systemic racism and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility. The Roman Catholic Church is yet to issue a formal apology. Activists, however, believe the government is trying to put the onus on the Catholic Church and downplay its central role.
The Canadian government currently is trying to kind of put the onus more on the Catholic Church, on the churches, but obviously the Canadian government is central to this whole horrific history and ongoing colonization.
Indigenous children are not the only victims of racism in Canada. Reports say thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. The National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls says a genocide is being perpetrated. But that's not all. A deadly attack on a Muslim family last month in Ontario and attacks on women wearing hijab in Alberta testify to the fact that racism has deep roots in the Canadian society. A new opinion poll shows some 36% of the Indigenous people and 42% of minorities believe Canada is a racist country. Canada, a country with a dark colonial history, has for decades depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. But the latest discoveries of Indigenous graves and attacks against Muslims show Canada is yet to take meaningful measures to root out racism in its own society.
Every year in late June and early July, Iranians flock to the graveyard in southern Tehran and sprinkle rose petals on tombs. Buried here are the victims of a terrorist attack in 1981 that bombed the central office of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, killing 73 key officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, who was viewed as the second man of the nascent Islamic Republic after its founder, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
I lost my father in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Party's headquarters. I was 9 back then. I still miss him so much, and I come here every year to commemorate him.
The killing of the Iranian politicians back then was a terrorist act that was supported by the U.S. The terrorists are now residing in France, so we ask the French government to hand them over to face justice.
The formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization took responsibility for the 1981 bombing. Known as the MKO, the terror group has a history of assassinations against Iranian statesmen and civilians, killing at least 12,000 Iranians.
Ask any Iranian about the MKO, and they will call them munafiqin, the Persian word for hypocrites. This is because they call themselves the crusaders of people's cause, but in fact, they killed people to climb to power. What's even more ironic is the fact that the U.S. and some other Western countries nourish the MKO terrorists.
This man is believed to be the spearhead of the 1981 terror attack. After the incident, Mohammad Reza Kolahi sought refuge in the Netherlands under the false identity of Ali Mohtamed, where he was warmly accommodated until he was disposed of by the MKO in 2015.
When Mr. Kolahi fled Iran to the Netherlands, Iran asked the Netherlands to hand him over, but it didn't do so. This shows that the West has a selective approach to terrorism.
This is not where the West's support for the terror group ends. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials. The 1981 assassination of Iranian officials, along with other similar events, such as the 1988 downing of an Iranian passenger plane by the U.S. Army and Iraq's chemical bombardment of Sardasht, falls in the same time frame, between June 26th and July the 3rd. U.S. footprints can be traced in all of the incidents. That's why Iran has designated this period as the Week of American Human Rights, as a jab that questions the U.S. double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
China is building up nearly 3,000-kilometer-long network of roads, railway lines, and investing tens of billions of U.S. dollars in Pakistan's energy and infrastructure projects under its mega Belt and Road global initiative. The major road infrastructure links western China to deep water port in southwest of Pakistan, 75 kilometers east of Iran, at the top of Arabian Sea. The U.S. feels threatened over expansion of Chinese economic influence in the rest of the world through Gwadar Port, which also serves as an alternative option for Beijing in the event of military blockade of Chinese Navy in South China Sea by the U.S. and its allies. The U.S. has been pressurizing Pakistan into shelving Chinese mega projects, calling it a debt trap. Washington has been struggling hard to win over Islamabad in its what appears to be a cold war with Beijing over growing Chinese economic influence in the world.
Pakistan thinks that it is very unfair for the U.S. or other powers, Western powers, for countries like us to take sides. Why do we have to take sides?
It's not going to happen that if Pakistan is, there's pressure put on Pakistan to change its relationship or downgrade its relationship with China. It won't happen. Our relationship between the two countries, no matter what pressure is put on us, is not going to change.
We do not expect that living at the backyard of such a rising power, which happens to be luckily our strategic partner, how could we downgrade our relation with them and side or be more close with someone who is 10,000 miles away? So it is very unrealistic to expect of Pakistan. Militarily, we would not involve ourselves in the conflicts of the region.
The unprecedented cold shouldering to the U.S. has followed a series of Pakistan's policy decisions to no longer get itself involved in any U.S.-driven military conflict across the region. Islamabad has outrightly rejected the U.S. request to set up military bases in Pakistan. The American CIA chief, William Byrne, who was on a secret visit to Pakistan a few weeks ago, was reportedly snubbed upon his request to see Prime Minister to reconsider his decision on military bases. Javed Rana, Islamabad. Thank you.
Aside from the enormous death toll, COVID-19 has wreaked economic havoc across the 27-nation EU. The Brussels Economic Forum, the European Commission's flagship annual event focusing on the economy, has just heard that young people have been disproportionately impacted.
We have a whole generation of youth that have had their education and their early labour market careers disrupted. So we really have to pay attention to those groups and try to move forward better.
Apparently, the EU is ill-equipped to create jobs because it's behind the curve when it comes to the digital technology sector.
Before, we were just lagging behind the United States and Japan at some stage. Mm-hmm. Now we are lagging behind the US and China.
Education systems in the EU need to be reformed so that young people can receive training for quality jobs, it has been suggested.
If you're from the north of Europe or the south of Europe, the east of the west, young people desire one thing. They want to build their future, they want to build a family, and this comes with a quality job.
The EU's handling of the coronavirus pandemic was criticised at the Brussels Economic Forum. A senior official recalls Russian medical supply trucks rolling into his home country of Italy in February 2020.
They had written in the tracks from Russia with love. And in the same weeks, we had export bans of medical equipment among European countries.
The EU's slow response to the pandemic has economic consequences, experts point out.
The United States, earlier than Europe, made huge progress on vaccines as soon as Joe Biden came into office. It also put forward an even bigger economic recovery package.
The event heard that Western nations rely too heavily on the arms industry and financial services sector when it comes to growing GDP. That's the total monetary value of any given country.
In contrast, imagine a good society, a harmonious one, where people feel safe, where they are healthy.
Contributors reminded the Economic Forum the EU was still struggling from the 2008 financial crisis when COVID-19 arrived. They warn if citizens are not treated better this time, the EU will fall apart. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad Airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
The 10th session of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union, hosted by the Iranian broadcaster, the IRIB. The event brought together representatives of 300 television and radio channels from 33 member states who attended the event through video conference. This year, the session was held with the motto of media justice,
and freedom of speech.
The 10th General Assembly of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union comes as the websites of several of its affiliated media outlets were seized by the U.S. government, something which the union views as an attempt to silence dissenting voices.
Last week, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation confiscated the websites of Press TV and three dozen other Iranian and regional media outlets for what it described as a means to combat disinformation. Addressing the ceremony in Tehran, head of the IRIB, Abdul Ali Ali Askari, condemned the U.S. move as an open violation of freedom of expression, calling it a failed attempt to muzzle the truth.
The extent of the effectiveness of resistance media outlets prompted the U.S. government to breach its own norms regarding free speech and take down those media. So this shows that those media have been successful. But the West must know that their move indicates their weakness, and on the other hand, the seized media will not stop working.
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union is a multinational entity, which is currently comprised of 228 member media outlets from 33 countries, covering a total of 22 different languages. The main goal of the union is to break the Western monopoly on media and to offer an alternative narrative for regional and global developments, as opposed to the narrative presented by mainstream media. The union says the West has engaged itself in a full-scale media war to silence the alternative voices.
The slogan of freedom of expression is just a tool for the West to impose its will on different countries. Those media outlets that speak the truth and enlighten the minds of the world nations face censorship just because they expose truths that come at the expense of Western interests.
Head of the IRIB World Service, Peyman Jebeli, says the West can no longer pull the plug on the resistance media since they have already reached global audience, including Western societies.
This time, we witnessed global solidarity with the people of Palestine in their resistance against Israel. Hundreds of thousands of people in Chicago, London, and elsewhere in the West voiced their support for Palestinians. Does the U.S. think it can prevent the voices of Palestine resistance from reaching America by blocking our media outlets?
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union says any attempt by the West to take down independent media is doomed to failure, and they will continue to shed light on the truth. However, member media outlets say they will sue the U.S. for its illegal media crackdown and will take measures to restore the seized websites. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Nearly 500 people may have been killed by record-breaking temperatures in Canada's westernmost province, as officials warned a grim death toll from the heat dome could rise again as more deaths are reported. On Friday, 2nd of July, British Columbia's chief coroner said that 719 sudden and unexpected deaths had been reported over the past week, triple the number during a similar period in a typical year. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Leighton Secco. The piece is titled Record Heat Wave May Have Killed 500 People in Western Canada. Nearly 500 people may have been killed by record-breaking temperatures in Canada's westernmost province of British Columbia, as officials warned a grim death toll from the heat dome could rise again, as more deaths are reported. On Friday, 2nd of July, British Columbia's chief coroner said that 719 sudden and unexpected deaths had been reported over the past week, triple the number during a similar period in a typical year. We are releasing this information as it is believed likely the extreme weather British Columbia has experienced in the past week is a significant contributing factor to the increased number of deaths, the chief coroner, Lisa Lapointe, said in a statement. The coroner's office said it would typically expect close to 230 deaths in a similar period. The overall total will probably rise after more communities provide data. But the chief coroner, Lisa Lapointe, said the province has been a promising downward trend in recent days as the heat ebbs and shifts eastward. Officials have cautioned it will probably take months to determine the exact cause of death for hundreds of residents, but they say heat played a significant role in the surge in fatalities, especially among seniors in the province. Many of the deaths experienced over the past week were among older individuals living alone in private residences with minimal ventilation, Lisa Lapointe said in her statement. In a region of the country accustomed to mild summer temperatures, communities were forced to scramble to find ways to help vulnerable residents stay safe amid blistering temperatures. But regional officials are facing growing questions over the response to the heatwave crisis. On Thursday, 1st of July, the head of the province's emergency health service apologized after residents were made to wait hours for ambulances during the worst of the heatwave. Global News reported that British Columbia's Emergency Services Center, which allows paramedics to be redeployed to high-need areas, wasn't activated until after the worst of the heat wave had passed. The weather system that enveloped large swathes of the Pacific Northwest broke 103 heat records across British Columbia, Alberta, Yukon, and Northwestern Territories earlier this week, according to Environment Canada. The heat has done little to help a province already vulnerable to the devastating effects of wildfires. At least two people are believed to have died in a wildfire that destroyed the village of Lytton on Wednesday, 30th of June. Police attempted to search for missing residents, but dangerous conditions have prevented them from entering the community. Late on Friday, 2nd of July, 136 active wildfires were reported in British Columbia, including nine which were of concern, according to officials. The dry, hot weather is expected to continue for the next week, hampering efforts to gain control over the wildfires. With an unprecedented heat wave that has left hundreds of people dead in British Columbia, Canada's westernmost province is now battling a fresh threat. More than 130 wildfires are burning across the province. As of late on Thursday, 1st of July, 86 of which started in the past 2 days. Evacuation orders and alerts have already gone out in a dozen communities. The province's premier, John Horgan, suggested that the crisis could become dire enough to see the Canadian military being deployed. There was a similar picture in western United States. Hundreds of firefighters battled the high heat against several wildfires in the forests of Northern California, where the flames have already forced many communities to evacuate. Mount Shasta, the volcano that towers over the region, was shrouded on Thursday, 1st of July, in a haze of smoke plumes so huge they could easily be seen in images from weather satellites in space. In British Columbia, Western Canada, it was supposed to be a week of tentative celebration. Thursday was the day that the province's COVID-19 state of emergency was lifted. But now the province is likely to be facing a new state of emergency over the wildfires. Absolutely, we may well, depending on how the wildfire season starts to unfold, require a provincial state of emergency, such as we have seen in our past 5 seasons in this province, the province's public safety minister, Mike Farnworth, said. In the village of Lytton, where a wildfire struck with such fury that residents had mere minutes to evacuate the village, an unknown number of residents were still unaccounted for on Friday, 2nd of July. Community Facebook groups were brimming with posts by residents desperate to track down their missing loved ones. Meanwhile, the Vancouver Sun has reported at least 2 people died attempting to shelter in a hole in the ground as the wildfire raged on.
Africa Today.
French President Emmanuel Macron says he recognizes that his country bears a heavy responsibility for the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, in which nearly 1 million people had lost their lives in a period of only 100 days. Now, during a recent visit to Kigali, Macron failed to meet the expectations of many who wanted him to apologize for the genocide. An activist working with Rwanda genocide survivors insists that France must apologize. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today. I'm your presenter, Mubarak Kenyam. Now, this week's edition is focusing on crimes by 2 major European powers in Africa. In the first segment of our program, we are analyzing the recent visit to Rwanda by President Macron of France, where he publicly acknowledged his country's terrible responsibility in Rwanda's genocide, but refused to apologize. In the second part of our program, we shall discuss the genocide perpetrated by Germany in Namibia over 100 years ago. Now, to compensate for its atrocities, the German government recently offered an apology and pledged 1.1 billion euros only in financial aid over a 30-year period. The descendants of the genocide victims have rejected the aid offer and are demanding full reparations.
We are living in poverty because of what they did to us at that time. Now we want them to restore our dignity. Reparations must come, and we want our land back.
Join us till the end of our show as our analysts delve deep into these 2 subjects.
Macron refuses to apologize over Rwanda genocide. Survivors of the 1994 Rwandan genocide say they're disappointed after French President Emmanuel Macron gave no clear apology over his country's role in the massacre of almost a million people in the African country. Speaking during a visit to Kigali last May, Macron claimed that France was not an accomplice in the Rwanda genocide and thus refused to offer an apology. The French president gave his speech at the Kigali Genocide Memorial Center at Gisozi, where some 250,000 victims of the 1994 genocide are buried.
Macron's visit follows the release in March of a report by a French inquiry panel that said a colonial attitude had blinded French officials and the government bore a serious and overwhelming responsibility for not foreseeing the genocide. However, the report absolved France of direct complicity in the killings. In April, Rwanda also released a report on France's role in the genocide against the Tutsi. For an incisive analysis on this subject, we have contacted Claude Gachebuke, a Rwandan war and genocide survivor, and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We also have with us here today Philip Rengens, an author and academic. He has acted as an expert witness on the law and politics of Rwanda, Burundi, and the DRC in national courts in several countries, and before the International Tribunal for Rwanda. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, let's start with you, Gachebuke. Why has Macron accepted French responsibility in Rwanda genocide but refused to offer an official apology?
Since the genocide, there has been accusations, including court cases in France, where the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, has been accused of shooting down the plane of his predecessor, President Juvenal Habyarimana. And the shooting of the plane sparked the genocide. So the French have gone back and forth with the Rwandan government with a love-hate relationship. My sense is that Emmanuel Macron does not actually believe in what he's saying, because if he actually did, he would offer an official apology. But I'm sure he wants to leave this hanging over the government of Rwanda, that when they would like to bring up this accusation again of the Rwandan president shooting down the plane and the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which is the party in power, being responsible for the crime that started the genocide, that sparked the genocide, that they could still reopen the case.
Thanks for that. Now, it's quite an interesting viewpoint. Edige Nkuranga, the president of IBUCA, an umbrella organization that connects group aiding survivors of the genocide, has condemned Macron, saying he did not present a clear apology for France's role in the 1994 genocide. Let's now bring in Professor Rengens. Why did Macron refrain from apologizing over France's involvement in the Rwanda genocide?
Well, it may well be that he felt, and he will probably have been advised on that, he might feel that if you offer apologies, a claim for reparations might follow. Remember, the German government apologized for the genocide of the Herero in current-day Namibia, and Germany is now paying pretty hefty reparations. So I suppose Macron didn't want to expose France to a demand for reparations.
Countless thousands of children were slaughtered during the Rwandan genocide that was enabled by France. Proof of the carnage is still visible throughout the country. Across the country, individual killers carried out their work with unfathomable cruelty. A survivor explains here how children were killed.
Yeah, it was full of children, died. They took the children, they dropped on the wall, they put on the wall. Like this, you see, these are the blood of children.
If France was to offer an apology to Rwandans over the genocide, what would be the implications?
An official apology, I think, would the implications would be that whoever is a responsible party in the genocide, including France and anybody else that would be shown to have had a role in the genocide, they would actually have to pay reparations. Their officials would have to be taken to court and face charges of genocide. And so I think that's a part of the reason why President Macron is avoiding an official apology. Although I do think that the government of Rwanda itself, the president of Rwanda himself, should also respond to the charges against him about sparking the genocide, because the genocide was sparked by the shooting of the plane, and a lot of his own officers have testified to it, including courts in France.
Official documents, survivors' testimonies, historic reports, books, and investigations have made available a barrage of information on France's participation in the Rwanda genocide. Researchers, however, estimate the classified secret documents in the government's archives still hide the truth.
Rwanda has long accused France of complicity in the 1994 genocide, but during Macron's visit to Kigali, President Kagame evidently softened his hardline stance. This is what he had to say after listening to Macron's speech.
His words were something more valuable than an apology. They were the truth.
Well, our last question to you, Professor. Why has President Kagame changed his previous hardline stance on France?
Well, I think both leaders had good reasons to try and establish normal relationships again. As far as Kagame is concerned, he has been, to some extent, I wouldn't say abandoned, but his usual allies, particularly the British and the Americans, have become more and more critical about his politics, about the level of democracy, human rights abuse, etc. It's also, I think, important for France because they have been, in part because of the conflict with the Rwandan regime, they have been basically out of Central Africa, or at least out of the Great Lakes region, which is an important region for them because it's a border between Anglophone and Francophone Africa.
Thank you very much, Professor Rengens. Professor is an author and academic, and he's also an emeritus professor of law and politics at the Institute of Development Policy, University of Antwerp. Now, back to you, Claude. Why is President Kagame eager to mend Rwanda's ties with France at this point in time?
Kagame's approaching of France is also a political move, because what has happened is, traditionally, Kagame has been a, if I can use this word, a puppet of the West. He's been basically a servant of Western governments, the UK and the US being the primary sponsors of Paul Kagame. And in recent years, they've started to distance themselves from Kagame and his government. And because of that, he's looking for new friends. And France itself is losing its influence on the continent of Africa, and Rwanda being one of the former French-speaking countries where France used to have an influence, I think France is trying to recover some territories.
France has deployed thousands of troops in several African countries to ostensibly battle terrorism, but despite this military presence, terrorists and bandits continue to wreak havoc in these countries where French troops are present.
Now, as we wind up, I'm sure you recall that the French military operation during the Rwanda genocide was carried out under the guise of a humanitarian mission. Is history repeating itself in other French military missions in Africa that are being carried out to ostensibly battle terrorism?
You know, you look at so many places where they're involved in the Central African Republic, you know, how close they are with Cameroon and Chad and so many others, and you can tell their reason for being there, and in Libya and Mali and so many other places, their presence is problematic. Even in the Ivory Coast, their history there. It's been a when the French go there, again, history repeating itself, they go there really to occupy, to take over, to take control of those countries, to install their puppet leaders, or to turn the leaders there, the current leaders, into puppets that they control and then take control of resources, and they do not actually care about fighting terrorism or saving lives. They are there to serve the interests of France, which are purely economic interests and not interest of saving human lives or even fighting terrorism.
Well, you have it there. France is pursuing selfish economic interests in its renewed engagement with African countries. Thanks a lot for your analysis, Mr. Claude Gatabuke, a Rwandan war and genocide survivor and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss the rejection of Germany's genocide deal with Namibia. So don't go away.
Namibians reject Germany's genocide deal.
From 1904 to 1908, German colonizers waged a brutal campaign of genocide against the Herero and Nama people in present-day Namibia. It was estimated that 65,000 of the 80,000 Herero, that is around 80% of the Herero population, were killed during the genocide. Some 10,000 of an estimated 20,000 Nama were also brutally killed by German colonial forces.
More than a century ago, after these atrocities it committed, Germany has now issued a late apology and promised development aid to those affected. Foreign Minister Heiko Maas says that Germany for the first time recognizes that it had committed genocide in Namibia during its colonial period. Many Namibians have rejected the so-called development aid being offered by Germany as compensation for its colonial-era genocide. A Namibian politician says Germany perpetrated the genocide and can therefore not purport to make a just and neutral decision on reparations.
Germany has been dictating. And for me, it was like a case of you have a murderer or a rapist, and this person is the one to decide whether I have raped or not, and should I find myself guilty, what could be the best punishment or verdict that I can give myself? So that is how the whole process was not acceptable to us.
Now, for an incisive analysis on this subject, we contacted Dr. Muginde Kajiua, Secretary General of the Oba Herero Traditional Authority. Thanks a lot for joining us today, Doctor. Now, can you first briefly elaborate to us on how the Nama and the Herero genocide took place in present-day Namibia during the German colonial rule?
The Nama and the Oba Herero genocide is a genocide. The German government issued two extermination orders, written, translated in local language, distributed, and then they implemented their intention as planned or as intended and carried out to the letter. Rounded Hereros and Namas refugees or prisoners of war, put them into concentration camp, ensure that they are put to heavy labor and also hanged, make sure that the population is reduced. In fact, at the end of the genocide, General Lothar von Trotter stated that the Herero Nation would never continue to exist as it was. He has completed his role, his job successfully.
Thank you for that, and we'll be back with more.
Germany agreed to pay Namibia 1.1 billion euros as it officially recognized the Herero-Nama genocide. Angela Merkel's government claims the payment amounts to a gesture of reconciliation, but not legally binding reparations. Herero and Nama leaders dismissed the deal as a public relations coup because it did not include funds deemed reparations. It has also been hugely disappointing to the Herero and Nama that the funds will be distributed over a period covering 3 decades.
The Herero chief, Bekui Rukoro, who died recently of COVID-19, was leading fierce opposition to the offer by Germany. He accused Germany of pursuing a racist policy by refusing to negotiate directly with those affected by the genocide.
And the only difference, Germany is continuing to refuse to sit down with us as victims of their genocide and extermination campaign, is because we are black Africans. So it's a racist policy.
Now, Germany has offered a 1.1 billion euro settlement, which has been rejected by the Herero and Nama leaders. Why have they rejected this deal?
We cannot agree to a product within which we are excluded. And in any case, the amount of money that they have agreed to is a slap in the face, is an embarrassment for the Namibian state. It's not even the value of land, over 50 million hectares of land confiscated in Namibia equates that much. The land alone that is taken by the colonizers, it's about 70, 75 billion euros. And that alone, the 100,000 lives that are lost, the displacement of people in the neighboring countries.
Descendants of the affected communities rejected the text of a joint declaration between the Namibian government and Germany, which omitted the word reparation. They also called for the renegotiation of the agreement with a focus on increasing the financial amount offered by Germany.
Now, what do you think should be done for justice to be served to the Herero and Nama people?
We have been consistent that we must revert back to the National Assembly resolution, which was unanimously adopted by the Namibian Parliament, which says the victim communities, the two governments must sit around the table, and the victim communities must be represented by their chosen leaders as victims of genocide, and they must propose to negotiate a package that addresses the needs of the victims wherever they are. So the negotiations must start afresh. We will not accept what is on the table.
Now, as you continue the struggle for the rights of the Herero and Nama communities, what's your message to the international community?
We're calling upon the international communities, peace-loving people, people that are fighting for justice, restorative justice. We're calling on that community to support us in our struggle for restorative justice. We hope the national governments will put more pressure on Germany to recognize the genocide and pay reparations. We will continue this fight. We will bring it to the United Nations, to the governments of the world, to ensure that Germany is pressurized through political pressure and negotiations, that recognizes genocide and pays reparation that is due to the victims of genocide in Namibia.
Well, thank you very much, the Secretary General of the Herero Traditional Authority in Namibia. Now, here at Face TV, we shall continue updating you on the continued struggle for reparations by the oppressed Herero and Nama communities in Namibia. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. And please, do send us your comments through our social media handle. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.